Today is March 22nd, 2021, and this episode is about domestic terrorism statutes. In wake of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, a lot of Americans, including our top policymakers, executives in the White House, and civil society groups, are asking questions about how this happened exactly and what we can do to safeguard our democracy and innocent lives from the threats that extremism poses in the United States. There have been a wide range of suggestions for answers to those questions, including things like tougher social media moderation, a review of the events of that day and the failures that occurred, and, seemingly most alarmingly in what this episode's going to get into, whether or not the national security apparatus in this country is prepared to handle these threats. Some lawmakers and intelligence officials have suggested the idea of creating a classification within federal agencies for domestic terrorist organizations. The intentions behind these may be good, arguing that they would be able to open up new legal avenues for surveilling and taking action on extremist groups before they turn violent. But these suggestions have raised huge red flags in civil rights groups across the country for reasons that Hannah Gase, a senior researcher at the SPLC, will explain to us here in a moment. In the case of January 6th specifically, all of the warning signs were in plain sight. The intelligence was there. Rather, my view is that the failure, ultimately, was the decision not to act on that intelligence and not to put proper precautions in place to combat what was coming down the pike. The more we learn about the events of those days, the more that we find out that police and federal agencies were incredibly aware of what was happening online and that decisions were made not to do much about it. Those failures to act have caused massive embarrassment for the agencies, and I think underscores why we have to be so careful around this idea. Let's go now to my interview with Hannah Gase, where we'll talk about these suggestions and what it could really mean in practice. Joining ShitPost now, we have Hannah, a good friend and a senior researcher at the SPLC. Hannah wrote a great piece in The New Republic called A New War on Terrorism is the Wrong Way to Fight Domestic Extremists. Hannah, what's up?
Not much. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing all right. It's been some months since the January 6th attack on the Capitol, and in addition to all the criminal cases playing out in court, there's also been a lot of discussion on Capitol Hill, in Biden White House, and Justice Department, and also civil society groups about how to confront right-wing extremism and the deadly threat that it often poses, and, you know, in addition, the threat that it posed to democracy itself in January. One of those suggestions that has kind of been floating around a little bit is this domestic extremism classification. This piece that you wrote is about that. First off, how would you summarize the argument for a domestic terrorism classification?
So basically, the argument put forward by proponents of this sort of approach is one that essentially claims that there aren't enough resources being put forward to tackle white supremacist extremism and violence in the United States, which, I mean, is correct. But then it basically takes the same approach that we saw after 9/11, which is then trying to turn this into an intelligence problem rather than a law enforcement one. Basically, proponents of this approach are claiming that a domestic terrorism statute would allow federal authorities to have additional legal powers to better monitor and take action against white supremacist extremists.
But in your piece, you argue that that is not a necessary component, and instead that we should, that, you know, we have plenty of the tools available. What are the hesitations or the problems that you found with a classification like that?
One of the biggest problems comes from just the origins of that approach. Essentially, what a domestic terrorism statute would look like is sort of the approach that we saw to tackling Islamic terrorism in the Bush and Obama era. And that resulted in these massive problems in terms of civil society and just gratuitous infractions of civil liberties, basically against Muslim Americans, but also just people of color more broadly. That, I think that's one of the biggest issues, is like, even if that didn't happen now, which I'm not convinced that this would just be leveraged against white supremacist extremists.
Right. I think there would be pressure to give the appearance that they're tackling all extremists. And, you know, we've seen even just in recent memory of the Trump years, what that looks like. And it can be kind of ugly.
Yeah, precisely. So like, Trump's repeated call to designate Antifa, which isn't a group, a foreign terrorist organization, which again mirrors some of these calls to claim that we should designate white supremacist groups as foreign terrorist organizations, including ones that are based and organized initially in the United States. For me personally, and I think there's a fair number of people in this field who believe this too, is that under a president like Trump, and I think it's pretty reasonable to believe that given the direction the GOP is going, we could get another Trump in, I mean, even just a couple of years or several years down the line, there's no reason to see these powers as being limited. And they would, I'm sure they would be used against the left. I'm sure they would be used, and like more specifically, I think they would be used against people of color by someone like Trump, who could be even more effective than Trump was on cracking down on political opposition.
Right. It's not so hard to imagine a scenario where either Trump himself, if he runs again, or whoever the successor to, you know, the Trump movement may be, using a tool like this to go after a group like Black Lives Matter. You know, that has been characterized by many Republicans as a extremist group. You know, something that I have kind of cautioned people about is, once you expand these kind of powers and expand these kind of scope, it's really hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube, to use a cliche. You know, the Patriot Act after 9/11, none of that's been rolled back. You know, it's, this stuff has a tendency of just kind of perpetually sticking around after it gets enacted. And we have to imagine what the next Trump or, you know, other leader that does not have, you know, democracy's best interest in stake, you know, how could those tools be abused?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's inevitable that if these tools were developed, they would just ultimately be abused. It's really a question of when.
Right. So in your piece, you cite two kind of case studies to make the argument that, you know, we already have the tools that we need to combat this. You know, rather, the question is just kind of prioritization or action on behalf of law enforcement and different agencies. Can you talk about a couple of those case studies?
Yeah, so the first one was Matthew Q. Giebert, who was an official in the State Department. Giebert was actually outed by my colleague Mike Hayden as basically very deep in the white power movement. Giebert ran a group called the Helicopter Pilots, which was a branch of the Right Stuff. And that was just a small meetup, basically a small meetup group of white nationalists that occasionally gathered in Northern Virginia. But he also was a pretty prolific propagandist. And he mainly operated under a series of just various internet personas that were all united by this moniker Coach Finstock. But of course, these guys getting deplatformed from Twitter all the time. Like, I think Mike had managed to track down like 10 or 12 different handles that he used.
Right. They always try to come back on.
Yep.
That's an age-old tradition, is firing up the VPN and logging back on. No surrender.
Yeah, I mean, he recently got deplatformed again, and I don't think he's come back yet, but I'm sure it's just a matter of when. But basically, Giebert had managed to, I mean, he was working in the State Department for years, and he had managed to pass two background checks. And the second one was the most alarming, because he passed this background check, and essentially he had the top secret clearance. So it's a clearance that basically grants you pretty broad access to confidential documents throughout various levels of the federal government. It wasn't just limited to the State Department. I mean, all these federal employees who have to pass these checks, in Giebert's case, the level of security clearance that he had was about 5 years. They fill out this form called Standard Form 86, and there are questions about extremism on it, but it's specifically through a terrorism framework, which, of course, in U.S. culture has basically meant Islamic extremism. And Giebert managed to, most unnervingly, get this security clearance after attending Charlottesville. It has raised tons of questions, basically, about how this process works. Then the other figure is a former member of the Adam Waffen Division, which was a white power accelerationist group. His name was Joshua Bennett, and he operated the Ohio cell, which is really just him. But he was in chats with many very prominent members of this group, including basically some that eventually went on to cheer on acts of really horrendous violence. And Bennett talked a lot in these chats about basically the origins of his beliefs. And he basically claimed to have come to the white power movement through the army. And more specifically, he was fighting in the war on terror in Afghanistan. So I think both of these figures basically show sort of how extremists both move through the U.S. government, and also kind of just how there's really, they manage to do so basically because there are holes in finding these people, and they're able to cover up their beliefs. I mean, in Bennett's case, he wasn't a member of a white power group at the time he was in the army, but he talks a lot about basically his views of, and how he became a national socialist. And at one point in that transition from sort of just being more of a conservative to being this really hardcore national socialist who ascribed like terroristic views to himself, I mean, at one point he managed to be in the same room as Obama. It's alarming, to say the least.
Yeah, and in his case, he, you know, went on to use his training in the military to try to inform other members of Adam Waffen. But, you know, both of these cases are cases that we know about. Presumably, there are ones that we don't yet. But those cases were discovered, you know, reported out, and action was taken against them. Adam Waffen is just, I mean, I don't even know if it really exists anymore to any substantial degree. And Giebert was put on leave at the State Department. It's unclear whether he's still getting paid or how that resolved at the very end. These are two cases where this was discovered and action was taken, and there wasn't a domestic terrorism statute. So I'm curious your thoughts, having reported out this piece, you know, what your takeaways from that are.
I think one of the biggest takeaways that I had was that really just, and I mean, this maybe sounds a little simplistic, but really just how complicated this problem is. Because so much of the reason why figures like this are able to just exist within various levels of the U.S. government machine, I guess more specifically the national security state, is basically because so much of U.S. history is just really enmeshed with white supremacy, and this is really just an extreme expression of that view. And I think that's something that people on the left know. I mean, people in this field know, but it's become clear, especially after January 6th, just really what that means, I think, in terms of policy and just basically what we're up against. Because, I mean, yeah, they, like as you did point out, both of them were reprimanded in some form or another. I mean, in Beckett's case, not really much happened to him personally, but obviously Adam Waffen was basically torn apart as a result of various arrests. It's just hard because you have all these individual cases, and then those individual cases get handled, but the problem itself is systematic, and there's not really anything that's really tackling that systematic problem. Yeah, I mean, I guess the main takeaway I had from this is just really, how can you basically tackle that systematic problem of just white supremacist extremism and its relationship to U.S. history without really just actually grappling with that on an existential level.
So the U.S. government has already taken some steps. I know that the Biden administration was having a 100-day sprint on a lot of these questions. I think we're probably due to kind of hear what they've come up with in the near future. There's also been some action at the Department of Defense, you know, instructing a temporary stand down to address extremism within the military. What's your personal take on, you know, these kind of actions? Does it seem like the message is being received that there has to be a different way to go about this than expanding national intelligence?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're positive steps. I think the stand down in and of itself was kind of a positive step. It sounded like, based on some of the reporting around it, that maybe because this was basically handled by individual units, that there could have been some issues there. Some of them were a little more extensive than others, just in terms of talking about the issue. Other units, basically, it kind of sounded like it was not handled quite as well. That's probably just going to happen anyway, but it still was a good step in the right direction. The thing I am kind of concerned about, and this is actually, Ken Klippenstein had a good piece on this recently, is some of the steps that are now being taken that do sort of resemble this push for kind of a more expansive security state gathering intelligence on who they deem extremists. So in one instance, the Pentagon is basically, as Ken reported a couple of days ago, we're talking about the idea of potentially more continuously monitoring military personnel on social media, which is pretty disturbing. I mean, it's sort of hard to imagine, especially some of the companies that were maybe going to be involved in this. They don't seem great. Let's just put it that way. So I think it's good that there were some steps to basically kind of tackle this on a cultural level in the case of the military, that there's been this really big push for more data and just kind of information about the extent of the problem, which I think is one of the biggest issues here, because it keeps coming up in these various hearings, is like, how do you talk about the extent of extremism in the U.S. government if you don't have numbers?
Right.
So I think all that's important, and it's a good step in the right direction. But like, I think as we're seeing from some of these debates about the January 6th commission, is like, the real elephant in the room is the GOP.
Right. That's something that it is very hard to confront. It is entirely unfortunate that that is the situation. But yeah, it has to be reconciled with the fact, you know, like, different members of like the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys and whatever, they've been arrested. They're, you know, on trial for participating in the attack. But to date, some of the key organizers and major political voices that were pushing these falsehoods and riling people up have seemingly walked away untouched. And I really think it's, you know, those bigger fish that need to be confronted. So you wrote in the piece, you know, towards the end here, that fixing this issue is not, there's no real like silver bullet piece of legislation or expansion or anything that is going to fix white supremacy in the U.S. and the risks that it poses. Instead, it's going to have to be a probably huge and probably large cultural project. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. And actually, one of the things that really stuck with me when I was working on this is something Cynthia Miller Idris of Peril at American University, that's the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab, said, which is basically, if you don't want securitized future and a securitized approach to addressing white supremacy, you really just have to start targeting it more at its roots. And a lot of that, yeah, I mean, that does have to do with addressing culture. So a big chunk of it really has to do with tackling some of the disinformation that, for instance, helped perpetuate this big lie, quote unquote, around the election, and just better inoculating people against that sort of information. I mean, there's only so much that deplatforming disinfo can do. That's a big first step. I think another aspect of it too is really helping people both understand how radicalization happens, I mean, that's a process. It's not really like you wake up one day and you're a Nazi. That right. that just doesn't happen. And
yeah, people don't sit around and like pull up a video on an obscure video platform and watch it and just be like, damn, you know what? Maybe I was wrong about Hitler. You know, that just doesn't happen.
You don't log on to YouTube one day and say, just damn, that Hitler guy, he has some great ideas. There's usually something that happens in between there. or, of course, the Matt Wars cartoon where it's basically you're just parroting that whole line about, if you just keep calling someone a Nazi, they'll become one.
Right.
and making fun of that. That's just, yeah, that's timeless. But yeah, I think part two is basically just helping people identify how radicalization happens. And then also for those people who are undergoing it or kind of trying to deal with leaving the white power movement, or even also just dealing with things like QAnon too, just helping provide off ramps and helping organizations that do that sort of work. And then part three, I think, is just like the broader cultural issue of just addressing this question of white supremacy being at the basis of U.S. history, ultimately, and finding ways to navigate that and tackle it. Because really, at the end of the day, if you don't do that, this is just going to continue.
So in your opinion, is this something that the government should take on or outside groups? Because the idea of like a massive education program coming from the government, I feel like could be less effective, especially if there's millions of people in the country that don't trust the government and will be immediately suspicious of anything that comes out of it. So that's been a question I've been trying to grapple with in my head personally is, you know, even if we get an idea of the kind of work that should be done, who should do it? Like, who would be most effective? And generally, you know, I'm curious if you agree or have different thoughts, but, you know, increasingly what I'm coming up with is that it's going to have to be, like, kind of everything at once.
Yeah, I also agree, especially given, I mean, I guess, like, maybe some of the history of government interventions into this issue. Like, I'm a little skeptical of the U.S. government being able to kind of tackle that sort of wide-scale education campaign effectively. It is true, though, that in places in Europe, it has been able to basically provide support for that sort of educational model. But the U.S. culturally, especially given, I mean, some of the deeper ingrained suspicions, I mean, not just in the far right, but just kind of more broadly in U.S. politics of these sorts of government interventions, I think it does pose a sort of unique problem. But I think broadly, yeah, it's definitely a civil society thing. I mean, there's ways that government and agencies can provide funding and support, I guess, but it really does have to come from the grassroots. And that's difficult to do because that basically takes all of us. And it takes the entirety of American culture to basically say, like, hey, this is a problem and we all need to tackle it together. And I don't know.
That's a hell of an ask.
Yeah, exactly. It's a lot.
I mean, you would think everyone could agree on, like, okay, we all agree that, like, white supremacists, particularly violent ones, are bad, right? And I mean, you would think there would be consensus on that, but the year is 2021 and this is America, so who knows?
Yeah, exactly. It's hard to say. But broadly, I would say definitely it's a big cultural push and it really just has to come from everyone.
Well, we're running up on time here. Hannah, I think you've been on the show before, but the last question to you is, what's your favorite thing on the internet right now?
So I think it would be the Onion's coverage of the conflict in Palestine right now. But particularly,
it's just been brutal.
It's just been brutal, classic Onion. But particularly this article that dropped today about AP fires journalist at Palestinian civilians. So referencing this poor AP journalist who was, well, now former AP journalist who was fired for her involvement in Students for Justice in Palestine in college, which, I mean, it was just utterly ridiculous on AP's part.
It's so terrible.
But I'm just, the picture too is just,
yeah,
wow.
Oh, so good. All right, Hannah, I'll let you get going here. Where can people check out your stuff?
You can find me on Twitter, where I am always too online, at Hannah Gaze. And you can also find me at splcenter.org, frequently writing for Hate Watch.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on Shitpost. We'll talk soon. That was my interview with Hannah Gaze. Thanks for listening this week and every week to Shitpost. Be sure to leave us a good review in iTunes or wherever you're listening to podcasts. It helps us a lot. If you really like the show and the kind of topics that come up on here, you can go to Substack at shtpost.substack.com, where paid supporters of the show will get an article, newsletter type thing every other week between shows. This has been Jared Holt. I'll see you in 2 weeks.